Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Friday. Jimmy Akins here. We've already had a little groovy music, probably some groovy music yet to come. But what we're here to do is answer questions. And if you've got one, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. What can you ask about? Well, have you ever heard of the topic called anything? That's right. It's Ask Me Anything this hour. Ask whatever you like of our guest, Jimmy Akin, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and the Jimmy Akin Podcast. And guest on about a million other podcasts, including this one. You can call and ask whatever you like, 888-318-7884. And Jimmy is back and ready to go. And every single line is lit, Jimmy.
Okay.
All right, back to work we go then. Davis is in New England, listening on Catholic.com. Usually people give the name of a specific state, but you're just in the general area of New England, huh, Davis?
Yeah, like the wrestlers say, from parts unknown.
Okay.
That's not necessarily particularly helpful to me because my friends, now my knowledge of geography gets fuzzy once you're above the Mason-Dixon line. And I would identify places as part of New England that my friends from up north tell me are not. Like, for example, New Jersey.
Oh,
okay,
no.
So it's got New in the name, and Jersey is British Island.
Right.
So I want to think of New Jersey. Of course, it's New England. It's right there in the name. But no, they tell me New Jersey is not New England.
It is, in fact, not.
Sorry.
Davis wants to get to his question. Go ahead, Davis. Usually we're trying to move the person to the question.
It's like for once, we're the ones who are delaying getting the question.
All right, Davis, go ahead.
So when I was in college, I started to be interested in history, and I read the Will and Ariel Durant Story of Civilization series, which I think is 11 volumes, and really enlivened my interest in history. But I guess it's, according to professional history, it's kind of hit or miss.
It's also dated.
So I'm wondering if Jimmy said, if you were going to start your study of history again, is there a series of books that you would recommend or an approach?
Well, unfortunately, you've already eliminated the first one that comes to my mind, which is the Will Durant series, The Story of Civilization. There are shorter works that are more recent and that are going to – and what Will and Ariel Durant did was a monumental accomplishment, but nobody can be an expert in everything in world history. And they also wrote decades ago. So we have, there's been a lot more historical research done since then. I'm not closely familiar with anything else of a general survey nature of world history. I mean, I think I've got a couple of books in like audiobook format of about world history that are much shorter than the Durant series, and more recent, but I don't tend to study world history as a whole. What I tend to do is study particular aspects of world history. So, and frequently primary sources. So like if I want to know about, Roman history, I'll go read Tacitus and Suetonius and Dio Cassius. These were Roman historians. Or if I want to know, about the ancient world in general, I might read Herodotus, the father of history. Or I may read a book on Egyptology, or I may read a book on prehistory, the origins of the human race. Or I may read a book on the American Civil War or any number of different things. But I'm afraid I don't have a curated list for you of here are some series that survey the whole of world history. So I guess my best advice would be to to just go on Amazon and type in world history and see what comes up. And then maybe after you have a basic kind of overview of world history, digging down into particular periods of world history, either using secondary sources or even better, primary sources.
Okay, Davis.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you for the call. All right, let's go to Donald in Plainsboro, New Jersey, which is not a part of New England. We've just established. Listening on Domestic Church Radio. Glad to have you here, Donald. Go ahead with your question.
And as a reminder, New Jersey used to be in the Dominion of New England.
Oh, it did?
Yes.
There's a twist to this story then, Donald. Thank you very much. I will be looking that up. Go ahead with your question.
And New York was once New Amsterdam.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Okay, I guess I'll ask my question. I was wondering when Jesus first knew that Judas Iscariot would betray him.
Well, we don't know the answer because we're not told. We do know that he knew it before the Last Supper, or at least before the Last Supper in a couple of ways. One of the ways is at the Last Supper, he predicts Judas's betrayal. But we also know that he definitely knew it before then, because in John's Gospel, at least this is what we're presented, at one point before the Last Supper, Jesus tells the disciples, have I not chosen you, and yet one of you is a devil? And he's referring, of course, to Judas. So that could mean that he knew Judas would be in his, now, in his divine intellect, God knows everything because he's omniscient. And so in his divine intellect, Jesus always knew that Judas would betray him. But in terms of his human intellect, which is finite by its nature because it's human, when did knowledge of Judas's betrayal enter Jesus's human intellect? Well, it's possible that he knew it before he even chose Judas. And that could be suggested by his reference to choosing them, even though one of them is a devil. Having said that, you could read that another way. You could say, I chose you guys, and at that time, he didn't know Judas would betray him, but he later realized Judas would. I mean, just based on the language used, I can't exclude that meaning. According to the church's understanding, and this is in the section on Christ's human knowledge in the Catechism, Jesus knew everything that pertained to his mission that he had come to reveal. And since his dying on the cross was something that pertained to his mission, I think based on that, you can make an argument that he would have known that Judas would betray him from the beginning. I can visualize ways to argue against that, but I would say the specific moment, if there ever was a specific moment where this came into his awareness, is something we're simply not told the answer to. We know he knew about Judas's betrayal before the betrayal, but exactly how far before is something we're not directly told, and so that's a matter of opinion. Some people could say, oh, he knew it all the way through his life, or at least he knew it, you know, from the beginning of his ministry, or he knew it at some point in his ministry. But I think that's something on which Catholic theologians could have differences of opinion.
Donald, thank you for a very interesting question. I appreciate that. We got to take our first break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
EWTN Radio Essentials is now EWTN Radio Extra. It's the past, present, and future of Catholic radio. You'll hear classic programs from Mother Angelica and Dr. Scott Hahn, plus timeless devotionals and award-winning podcasts from our partners on EWTN's Podcast Central. Listen now to EWTN Radio Extra on the EWTN app, on smart speakers, and on EWTN.com.
Back, Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. Everything's on sale over at shop.catholic.com. Check it out. It's called the store-wide sale because everything's on sale, and it's well-timed for Father's Day and confirmations and graduations and the like. A huge selection, including lots of Jimmy Akin materials, the popular books we talk about, like The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense and all the others, all on sale at shop.catholic.com. Off we go next to Colorado. Uriel in Colorado is on the line. Welcome. You got a question for Jimmy?
Oh, hi. Hello, Jimmy. Yes. So my question, if I have already confessed my sins to the Father, do I have to confess those same sins again? Well, to be more specifically, in my situation, I have found myself reflecting on my past actions, and I have repented for the things I've done, but the memory of those actions pains me. And, well, so my question would be, would I or do I have to confess the same sins more than once?
So have you, when you say you've confessed your sins to the Father, have you also gone to sacramental confession?
Yes.
Okay. Once you have confessed a sin in sacramental confession and been absolved, you do not need to confess it again. If the memory of it still causes you distress, reconfessing it is not the answer to that. And let me ask you another follow-up question. Have you ever been told, maybe by a priest or someone else, or just from your own reading, do you show any signs of scrupulosity?
I'm not sure what that means. Could you explain
that? Okay. So scrupulosity is a condition where people have an unhealthy perception of what is and is not sinful. They may worry, for example, this is an extreme example, but there are people who have this. It's also related to another psychological condition called obsessive compulsive disorder, where people have recurrent obsessive thoughts that are unpleasant that they can't get rid of. And many scrupulous people also have OCD, but some scrupulous people don't. But they may, for example, feel like, if I don't buy the right kind of bread at the supermarket, it's a sin. And there really are people who feel that way. And that would be an excessive perception of sin. God doesn't really care whether you're buying Wonder Bread or some other kind of bread. And to devote that amount of thought to that question is excessive. But there are people who have that. To an extent, scrupulosity is a normal part of the spiritual maturation process, because there's a balance to be found in the Christian life between having too broad an understanding of what's okay and too narrow an understanding of what's okay. So some people are too broad in thinking, oh, everything I do is fine, I don't have any sins to worry about. And other people think, have a too narrow a perspective and think, oh man, everything I'm doing is a sin. And part of the process of Christian maturation is figuring out the balance where you're neither too broad nor too narrow. You're neither a laxist, someone with a lax conscience who doesn't think anything is a sin, or someone who is scrupulous, who thinks everything is a sin. And finding that balance is the goal. But on the way to the goal, most people will pass through some stages where they're lax and other stages where they're scrupulous. So some scrupulosity is just because of spiritual maturation process. It's natural, especially when people are first beginning to take the concept of sin seriously. They tend to overestimate the sinfulness of things. So if you grow up lax and then you have a spiritual awakening, you may zoom to the other extreme and become scrupulous. Some people get stuck there because of obsessive compulsive disorder. So would you have tendencies either due to your age or the recency of your spiritual awakening or because of something like obsessive compulsive disorder, would you potentially be describable as someone who has scrupulosity?
I would say so, yes, more recently.
Yeah.
I've been baptized. I've done all the steps, but recently, these last 3 years, I've been looking into it a little more further, and prayers have been answered, and just things have been growing. I found myself to be on both extremes where I'm too self-critical and the shame hits me and I hide away I tend to hide away and put myself out if I ever get those thoughts or actions.
Okay. That's not surprising. Like I said, this is something that's very common. It's part of a natural growth process. There is, though, advice that is typically given to people who are going through a scrupulous phase, whether it's a temporary one or a more permanent one due to OCD. And that is, once you've confessed it, do not reconfess it. Because if you reconfess it, then it's going to lead to a cycle where you're reinforcing that behavior and you're going to end up reconfessing all kinds of stuff, whether it's that sin or some other sin. Fundamentally, confession is not therapy. If you have emotions of guilt that persist so that you keep feeling guilty, even though you've already objectively dealt with the sin by confessing it, you need to seek another kind of help for those emotions that you need to. So that could be a number of things. It could be getting spiritual counseling by talking about it with a counselor or, you know, Christian counselor or spiritual director outside of confession. It could be seeking conventional psychological therapy. It could just be sucking it up, because one of the things we need to do is have faith in what God did for us in confession. He really did absolve us through what the priest did. And we need to have faith in that. We don't want to be saying, oh, well, maybe God didn't really do it, so I need to reconfess. No, God gave the priest the power. I mean, Jesus told the disciples, whoever sins you forgive, they are forgiven. Whoever sins you retain, they are retained. If you want to look that up, it's at the end of John chapter. It's in John chapter 20. And so I would suggest, as a first step, meditating on that. And when these feelings come, look at John chapter 20 and read what Jesus says and take it seriously. Have faith in what Jesus said. And then based on that, you can say, well, I went, I confessed, I was absolved, so I should not feel guilty about this anymore. And take whatever emotions of guilt you have and set them aside. This is especially important when one is in scrupulosity. Now, when one is not in a scrupulous phase, there are things that can be learned from feelings of guilt, like, man, I don't want to do that again. But if you find yourself obsessing about these feelings of guilt, you need to set them aside. And the way to do that is not by going to confession again for the same thing, but using extra sacramental or non-confessional ways of dealing with the emotions. Because objectively, you've already dealt with the sin. God's already forgiven it. You don't need to worry about that sin anymore.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right.
No problem.
Uriel, thank you. Hey, if you'd like, I'd like to send you a little book that Jimmy wrote called The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. All you got to do is hang on the line, give us an address, and we'll send it off to you. And off we go now to Steve in Vancouver, Washington, listening on the Modern Day Catholic Radio. Glad to have you, Steve. Go ahead with your question.
Happy to be here. Thank you very much. I had a question about pope names that you were talking about earlier, and mm-hmm. that is, could a pope take a feminine name such as Joan of Arc?
Sure. Religious people do that sometimes. You'll have, monks, for example, who are men who nevertheless have a feminine name. Typically, it's paired with a masculine name. So, like, they might have a name like, you know, Brother Joseph Mary, but they've got the Mary in there. Similarly, women, religious, you know, nuns and so forth, sometimes take masculine names. So their name might be Sister Peter Maria or something. They've got Peter in there, even though that's a masculine name. It's also, so Pope could do that if he wanted, and he wouldn't have to include his own gender name. I mean, popes can be whatever they want to call themselves. So if he says, I want to just be called Pope Joan, then he would be Pope Joan. Now, that would send a very confusing signal to the faithful. So I wouldn't advise a pope to do that because of the problems that would cause. But in terms of could he, well, yeah, he's the vicar of Christ. He can be called whatever he wants. So that's possible. I think another possibility that's more realistic than that is he might use a masculine name, but point out, if he's not using a double masculine feminine name, but he might point out that this masculine name is in honor of a female saint. Like the masculine equivalent of Joan is John. And so he might say, I want to be called Pope John, and I picked my name as an allusion to Joan of Arc and all the great things she did.
Oh, okay, Steve, that makes sense to you?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. I was giving you a chance to talk, but I had you on hold. Sorry about that. Karen's in Louisiana, listening on 90.5 FM. Karen, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Absolutely. I'm glad to be here. Thank you. I wanted to find out about astral traveling. How do you protect yourself from attacks from those that are astral traveling to you, to attacking you? How do you protect yourself because it's unseen?
Okay, so you're talking about, now what you're referring to as astral travel, I assume, is what parapsychologists refer to as out-of-body experiences or OBEs. And so I want to make sure I understand you correctly. So you're in your body, you're not having an out-of-body experience, but you want to know how to protect yourself from someone who is having an out-of-body experience. Is that correct?
Correct. That are actually attacking you in their out-of-body experience, but you're not.
Okay.
They're experiencing what was happening.
Okay. Well, the first thing I'd want to know is how do I know I'm really being attacked? Even if someone is having an out-of-body experience, and even if they're trying to attack me, that doesn't mean they're going to have much of an effect. There has been research done on can people in an out-of-body experience have caused physical effects in the world. That's what's known as mind over matter or psychokinesis. And the answer is actually yes. For example, the American Society for Psychical Research back in the 1980s did a series of experiments with an out-of-body experiencer named Keith Harari. And they would do things like have Keith go down the hallway and then try to do something psychokinetic, try to have some kind of effect from his mind in the out-of-body experience over matter, like pull on this strain gauge, you know, and that'll show that if we see the strain gauge moves, you know, while you're having the out-of-body experience, that gives us confidence that you're doing it. And they had some positive results with that, but these were very minor effects. I mean, it's like a few grams. And so I don't think there's never been any demonstration that out-of-body experiencers have very much ability to affect things in the physical world. So I would doubt that they could. I'd also want to know how good is the evidence that this is even happening, because we can think we're being attacked when we're not. And people can plant suggestions in our minds. They can say, "Ooh, I'm going to attack you when I am having an out-of-body experience tonight," when really it's nothing is happening. Having said that, in terms of how one would defend oneself, well, if you're watching the video version, you may notice I've got a nice St. Michael the Archangel statue behind me that I've had blessed. And I say the St. Michael the Archangel prayer. And I say prayers to God and just say, you know, "Father, please, please protect me." If you want to imagine like a barrier around yourself, you know, to kind of use whatever mental abilities you may have to block anything, you can imagine a barrier around yourself. But I would say trust God. You know, ask your guardian angel or St. Michael for help. You could get a blessed St. Michael statue if you want, or you could get a St. Michael statue and have it blessed. You can imagine a barrier around yourself. But frankly, I wouldn't worry about it too much, because in the research that's been done on psychic attack, it does not appear that psychic attacks are really able to do that much, unless the person who is on the receiving end of the psychic attack believes that it's going to hurt them. So if you just have confidence, "This isn't going to hurt me," then it's probably not going to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Karen.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
Karen, I'd like to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It, if you would like it as well. All you have to do is hang on the line. We'll get an address and we'll send it off to you. That music means we have to take a very quick break, but we'll be back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. I think we're going to have two lines open during this little break, so a great time to call. 888-318-7884. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. A little bit of groovy music there for you. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything on Catholic Answers Live, and heading to Texas now. Nathan is in Texas. Nathan, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, Jimmy and Cy, good to talk to you right now.
Well, we're happy to have you here, Nathan.
All righty. My question is for my wife. She's a new Catholic, went through the RCIA program, and she had a question for me that I could not answer. Here's our question. We know that in the altar there is a, you know, somebody from the church, you know, that's in the past. Okay. Is it a saint? And I do know this is at St. Joseph's, the church that I was recently at. There's not St. Joseph relics. It's actually a pope. And so we're confused. Is the saint from that saint in the church? Or how does this work when it comes to a relic that's supposed to be in the altar? Thank you.
Okay, so what the Code of Canon Law says is that relic, the custom of placing relics of martyrs or other saints in the altars is to be maintained according to the principles in the liturgical books. So one would want to dig deeper in the liturgical books to find out more particular regulations. But the way I would take that is that it's not required that the parish have the saint, have a relic of the saint that it's named after. It may, and you could say that'd be a good thing, but it's not required. It's not even required that every altar have a relic. It doesn't say that. It just says this custom is to be maintained. So I would say that they could have a relic from any number of different saints in the altar of a particular church.
You know what, Nathan? I have a feeling, because your wife is a convert and you have, and she has a lot of questions and you'd like to be able to answer them, you might like our big book of Catholic answers. It's got 250 of the most common questions or most profound questions, maybe I should say, about the Catholic faith that people ask. And if all you have to do is hang on the line, if you want it, we'll send you a copy of the big book of Catholic answers. And on we go. Let's go to Jason in Charlottesville, Virginia, listening on the EWTN app. Welcome, Jason. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, thanks for taking me on.
Sure.
And my question is a very simple question, but maybe it's too simple to like, but okay. So why are we Catholic and why do we believe in God in like a conversational answer type way? Like, I know that you can write a whole book about that, but like in just a conversational answer, like how would you respond to that?
Well, so the question is, why do we believe in God and why are we Catholic in a conversational mode?
Yeah.
Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah.
Psychelet, that's something that you might have thoughts on. Why do we believe in God and why are we Catholic? What would you say in a conversation about that?
Oh, all right, Jimmy. Thank you. I might start with a kind of a methodological thing that I learned from Steve Dawson at St. Paul Street Evangelization. And he has a method he calls the one good reason method, which is just if you have a good reason why you believe in God, you could say to the person, well, let me give you one good reason why I believe in God. Or if you have a good reason why you're Catholic, let me give you one good reason why I'm a Catholic. And he likes that, and I like it, because it's not intimidating. You know, it's not like, oh, I'm now going to give you a 20-part course or something. It's just one good reason. I'm going to share one good reason. And the other thing I like about it is it's my reason. And it's hard to argue with someone else's reason in a mean way. It's more like that opens a conversation. And I think that's what we want to do, Jason. I think we want to open a conversation. So if someone said to me, why do we believe in God? Why do Catholics believe in God? I might say, you know, a good reason one good reason I have for believing in God is the world is not chaotic. That it makes sense. It seems planned. It seems organized. I can't imagine that all of that order and beauty is just an accident. And I might talk to about why that points to a creator for me. If someone said to me, well, why be Catholic? I might say, you know, one good reason why I'm a Catholic is that in the Catholic sacraments, I keep finding healing. I find that God really helps me in the sacraments, and then I would share some stories about that. How does that strike you, Jason?
Well, you might want to ask.
Because I think I could overthink it.
I'm sorry, I missed
it. Yeah. he says it sounds perfect, he might have been overthinking it.
Jimmy?
Similarly, something that I would add is, in terms of why be Catholic, is, well, Jesus founded a church, and the Catholic Church is the organic outgrowth of that original church, and others have split off from it. So if you want to be part of the church Jesus founded, you'd want to be Catholic. And then it would, if they want to probe deeper, you can, but that's the basic answer. Also, anytime someone's looking for advice on how to say something concisely, you know, one of the nice things we have these days is artificial intelligence. And while I haven't used it much, if you know, we've gotten a number of questions today about, well, how could I say this? That's exactly the kind of questions that artificial intelligence can provide helpful suggestions for. So one could go and say, you know, hey, artificial intelligence, give me a brief conversational answer for why believe in God, or give me a brief conversational answer for why be a Catholic. And it'll scan all the literature that's out there that it has access to and try to come up with something that could be helpful.
Jason, thank you very much for the call and for the questions. How about
In fact, we've got Father Justin at Catholic.com. You could ask him those questions.
Oh, yeah, and I'm sure that he would have answers to those. Jason,
because he's scanning all the right Catholic literature for that.
I'm giving away books. I'm in a book-given thing now, and I think maybe a Daily Defense. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Jimmy.
Well, I was going to say Words of Eternal Life, because it's focused on, here is a short, basic case for believing in God and in Christianity and in the Catholic Church.
Jason, you're getting both. If you hang on and give us an address, we'll send you a Daily Defense, 365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist, and the Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the call. The lines continue full. Off to Canada we go. Ray is up in Alberta, Canada, listening on the TuneIn app. We're glad to have you, Ray. Go ahead with your question.
Good. Thank you very much. I was born and raised as a Catholic here in Canada most of the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm really puzzled and kind of shocked by the fact, if I heard correctly, that Pope Leo XIII, way back in 1901, had a special message to announce the coming of a new century. And I thought that is really illogical, because the century turned at end of year, a year before that. And why would the Catholic Church, the hierarchy in the Church, who have a great respect for science and mathematics and so on, make such an illogical error in counting numbers, as simple as going from one century to the next one? And I'm hoping that our new Pope, Leo XIV, being a student of mathematics, maybe he can straighten some of this out a little bit and give the understanding that the turn of the century, for example, the next millennium that we're in now, we're in the second millennium, the millennium actually began after midnight of 1999, as soon as it turned to the year 2000. That would be the beginning of the new millennium, not anywhere else.
All right. Let's let Jimmy check. I think we've got it, but let's let Jimmy give you an answer, and we'll come back to you.
So while I hope Pope Leo XIV, who did get a degree in math, I hope that he has a nice long reign, I don't know that I expect him to be around for the turn of the 22nd century, because that's 75 years away. When it comes, and I think everyone would get tired after 75 years, I suspect even if he lived another 75 years, he would resign before he served out that long of a papal reign. In fact, I suspect if we have popes in the future, if we get really good life improvement technology so that people can live for 300 years, I suspect popes will regularly resign rather than saddle the church with the same point of view for 300 years. But having said that, the actual way the calendar works is that the century really does change when you hit an 01 and not when you see that first new number. So if you think about it, the first year in the Anno Domini system was the year one, because there was no year zero. Zero was not a thing in European mathematics when Dionysius Exiguus, or Dennis the Short, that was the name of the monk, came up with the AD system. So the very first year in the AD system was the year one. And if you then, the second year is year two, and so forth, you get up to 99, and that's the 99th year of the first century, but you need 100 years for a full century. And so the year 100, when you get that third digit and that new number on the front, that year 100 was the 100th year in the Anno Domini system. And so it's the 100th year of the first century. And that means the second century doesn't start till you get to 101. And that pattern replicates through all subsequent centuries. So the last year of each century is when you get the double zeros. That's the 100th year of the new century, and you get a new number at the beginning. But you don't have the next century start until you get 1 year beyond that. And so, so actually the year 2000 was the last year of the second millennium. And that would even be suggested by its name, 2000. That second for the two, and the thousand, that's the millennium. So this is the last year of the second millennium. The third millennium then properly began with the year 2001. And so that's how the calendar system works. I know it's counterintuitive that when you see if you've been seeing a bunch of 18s, like 1897, 1898, 1899, and all of a sudden you see a 1900, it's natural for us to think, oh, wow, that looks so different. It's got two zeros and it's got a new number on the front, and that makes it seem like it's a new century, but it's really not. It's really the last year of the century in question, the 19th century in that case. Having said that, so there's nothing really here to fix. The current system is working the way it was designed to work. Now, having said that, when the actual year 2000 was approaching, John Paul II decided to celebrate the millennium a year early. And so he had these big buildup of celebrations to the year 2000, which was actually technically a year early. And he did it for exactly the reason I mentioned. It's counterintuitive. When you see the big change, like from 1999 to the year 2000, it's natural for people to think of that as the change of the century, even though it's technically not. And he decided to capitalize on the fact that that's what everyone would naturally think by giving them a big celebration of Jesus when that happened, as opposed to saying, well, technically we're not going to celebrate till 2001. So he decided to pretend that this is when the new millennium began, even though technically it wasn't. So I would say nothing really needs correcting here, and the church has shown flexibility on exactly how we're celebrating stuff in order to help people.
Ray, thank you. That brings us to the break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1987. EWTN programming expands to 24 hours, reaching 10 million subscribers. This was implemented to cover the visit of the Holy Father, something not done by any other network, helping the audience have a direct connection even if they couldn't see him in person.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
back to Catholic Answers Live. The number 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. And I'm going to just keep going now. We got lots of folks on the line, so let me get folks on with Jimmy. Kim is in Colorado. Kim, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, and thanks be to God and the new Pope. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you.
I have a question regarding coming back to the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know, since I had never been married and I do have children out of wedlock, is it possible that I would, if I do get married later on, if is it possible to do anything to be able to get married in the Catholic Church or not?
Well, you haven't ever been married, so all you need to do to get married in the Catholic Church is apply to get married. You don't have a bond to any prior spouse that would prevent you from getting married, so you just need to apply to get married in the Catholic Church just like anybody else. The fact you have some children from outside of marriage isn't going to affect that.
Okay, that's good to know. And am I going to go to hell because I accepted the Eucharist at my relative that passed away funeral, even though I hadn't gone to confession before?
Well, if you knew for a fact that you should not receive and you chose to anyway, then that would be a sin. And it could hypothetically be a mortal sin if you did it with adequate knowledge and deliberate consent. But people at funerals are under lots of pressures, and they have the emotional pressure of grief. They have the pressure of what are other people going to expect of me to do in this occasion. And so that can diminish a person's capacity to give deliberate consent to an act. So it may not have been a mortal sin. Whether it was or wasn't, I would simply say, well, mention it in your next confession. Just go to confession and say, I took communion at this funeral mass where I hadn't been to confession in a long time, and just confess it and you'll be absolved and be free of it. And you don't need to worry about it beyond that.
Thank you. I appreciate that so much.
Well, Kim,
of course, there are no problems. God loves everybody. His church loves everybody. And there are always ways to repair situations.
Kim, I'd like to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. If you'd like it, hang on the phone, give us an address, and we will send it off to you. Thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Ignatius in New York. Ignatius, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. So I see a lot of times, a lot of state of a contest, people who believe there hasn't been a pope since the Second Vatican Council, and that every pope from Pope St. John the 23rd to Pope Leo the 14th is a false pope or an anti-pope. They'll often use the words of St. Robert Bellarmine to try and support their arguments, because it seems in St. Robert's defense of the papacy, he describes a scenario where a pope could be a manifest heretic, where he believes a pope could be removed. So I guess my basic question would be, is that what what exactly is St. Robert teaching precisely? How do we respond to state of a contest on that claim? And do any of St. Robert's words have any, like, theological standing, or is it just like a personal opinion that he comes up with?
This is a personal opinion, and as you can tell if one reads the source work, I'm a big believer not just in looking at individual quotations, but at looking at primary sources in context. And if you read what he actually wrote, and not just selective quotations from it, you see that he names like six or so different opinions that Catholics have on this question of what if a pope became a heretic. So there are multiple different opinions, and this is just one. And there are others that disagree, that say, well, no, the pope wouldn't cease to be pope if he became a heretic. So this is not church teaching. This is theological opinion, and there are contrary theological opinions. Also, I would second, so that's first point. Second point, canon law does not, which is the actual rules governing the church, does not incorporate this theological opinion. Once someone is a pope, the only way for them to lose that office is for them to either die or resign. There is nothing in canon law about if a pope becomes a heretic, he loses his office. There's a different set of procedures that govern what happens if someone becomes a heretic. And there are two kinds of responses. Now, a pope who became a heretic would and fulfilling all the qualifications of heretic. There are a bunch. But if he did fulfill all the qualifications of heretic, then he would be excommunicated, but it would be what's known as a laete sententiae excommunication. And you don't – here's the thing about laete sententiae excommunications is even if you are excommunicated laete sententiae, you don't lose your office. You're not supposed to use it, but you don't lose it, and you can still validly exercise your office. It's only if the excommunication is ferendae sententiae or declared by a competent ecclesiastical authority who's able to make this declaration that you lose the office. And since, as canon law also provides, the Holy See is judged by no one, that means only the Pope could declare himself excommunicated. So even if Pope were a heretic, the way canon law handles this, he wouldn't lose the office of the papacy unless he declared himself excommunicate. Then there's a third point, which is the most fundamental one. None of the popes from Vatican II onward have actually committed heresy. Heresy is a very specific ecclesiastical crime. It has a bunch of different things that have to happen for a person to be a heretic the way the church understands it. And none of the popes have even been in the ballpark of being a heretic. What happens with these seat of vacantists is they look at recent church teaching or practice and say, oh, that's a heresy, when in fact it's not. They have a poor understanding of what counts as a heresy, and they have a poor understanding of the authority level of prior statements and practices, and they misapply them in these situations. And for people who aren't careful in how they read church documents, they can sound convincing, because you can make any case sound convincing if you rip quotations out of context and you use terms in different ways than they were used at the time. So one of the things that's important in this area is getting a sense of how to read ecclesiastical documents and interpret them and figure out their levels of authority. And I wrote a whole book on that. It's called Teaching with Authority. And since Ignatius is in New York, which used to be New Amsterdam, but is still, as far as I know, part of the United States, let's see if we can send Ignatius a copy of Teaching with Authority.
Hang on, Ignatius. We'd love to send it to you. Let me see if I can get one more caller in here. Brock in Texas, you are going to have to be quick if you would like an answer from Jimmy.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Brock.
All right. Yeah, it'll be quick. So me and my fiance are engaged. I'm wondering if we can get civilly married prior to being sacramentally married.
Are either one of you Catholic?
We're both Catholic.
Okay. The answer
right now.
Okay. The answer in the United States is no. Some countries require people to get married civilly, separately from having a Catholic wedding, because they don't recognize weddings done by Catholic ministers. Germany, if I recall correctly, is a country like that. But here in the United States, the government does recognize Catholic marriages. And so the thing for Catholics to do is get married in the Catholic Church. If you were to just go down to the courthouse or something, or go to a non-Catholic minister and get married without permission from your bishop, that would not be a valid union, and you would not be able to morally lead a married life at that point. You need to, unless some very extraordinary circumstances apply, you need to do the normal thing, which is for Catholics to get married in the Catholic Church and not live as husband and wife before that.
Brock, I appreciate you got that question out quick enough to allow Jimmy an opportunity to get you an answer.
And I could make it sound better if I had more time, but given the brevity of time we have, I wanted to give a clear answer, even if I'd like to position it a little more gently in some ways.
I got you. Brock, thank you. Thanks to everybody who called. We gave away a lot of books today, so I will leave this room and walk past the customer service room, and maybe they'll yell at me about giving away so many books. I don't know. We're about to find out. Jimmy Akin has been our guest. Check out his podcast, The Jimmy Akin Podcast, and Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, the latter of those two, one of the most popular documentary podcasts anywhere. You can get them both wherever you get your podcasts, or check out Jimmy's YouTube channel. Jimmy Akin, it's always fun. Thanks for 2 great hours.
Thank you, Cy Kellett.
That will do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.